This episode of Rock Paper Podcast is brought to you by Gaslight Studios. Check them out over there on the corner of Kings Highway and Shaw Boulevard. The website is gaslightstl.com. Get on there and check out more information. You can come over there on July 30th and see Fresh Hair doing a live studio recording. You can hang out in the bar and watch them play and hear all the songs and be a part of the experience. Also, come hungry. There's a cha-cha-cha next door. Get some tacos and have a good time. So, again, check out GaslightSTL.com and be sure to like their page on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hey everybody, Shane Presley here to tell you about my friends over at Music Record Shop. Find them at 4191A Manchester Avenue, right in the heart of the Grove. They come out this Friday, and every Friday there's a brand new music happy hour going on. This Friday, July 29th, new vinyl in from Death Grips, My Morning Jacket, reissues from REM, and a whole lot more. 10% off any purchase, free beer from Four Hands Brewery, and new music spinning. If you want more information, please check out their Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and shop online 24/7 at musicrecordshop.com. This episode is sponsored by Game Trader 2 in St. Charles, Missouri. They wanted to tell you about Mo Game Con going on August 13th, and that'll be at Elks Lodge 330 in Afton, Missouri. Tickets will be $10 or $5 plus two canned goods. There will also be exclusive event t-shirts for sale, and vendors. Special guests include Adam Korelick of YouTube and the Rocket Punch Radio and Video Game Show podcast, and many others. There's going to be one going on. And like I said, lots of great local vendors and competitions and all kinds of things. So if you're into gaming, come check it out. August 13th, 12 to 7 p.m. in Afton, Missouri. Visit mogamecon.com for more information and tickets. That's mogamecon.com.
Podcast is kind of like it's like a radio show that's not on the radio, it's on the internet. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's also like my mom. It makes it sound more confusing, doesn't it? It sounds like this.
You go first.
No, really, you go first.
Okay, I'll go first.
Hi, this is Ron Stevens.
And I'm Joy Gridnick.
And we're going to be on Shane Presley's Rock Paper Podcast coming
Yay!
Up. We're so excited.
Yay, be there.
Hey everybody, Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri. We're at the fountain on Locust, right?
Yes.
We're above it. Yeah.
Right above it, yeah.
In a secret room.
Yeah.
Secret back room.
Now word will get out. There's a secret room up there.
Pretty good secret considering those windows are all there. You can see them when you look up.
And people come and say, "What's up there?" Yeah, and now they'll know it's Shane. Yeah.
But I guess I want to start first. I want to say thank you. Recently I was a guest on STL. I was
Joy mom. Skipped out that
yeah,
day. Yeah,
Joy wasn't able to make it.
Yeah.
So I actually got a chance to ask you questions. It was great.
Right. Yeah. But
I didn't get to ask the real questions.
Yeah. They
can today.
They helped. They helped you a little bit, or you know, filled in for when you were like you were saying that you would ask about my hair and stuff or something like that.
Uh-huh.
They were making some
the questions I won't ask.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it was pretty funny, but that video. You know, when that my segment hit the internet and like you know, my friends and family and everybody shared it around, and like it was pretty overwhelming, really. Like that it was quite
and that's what we want to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like what you're doing here. You're creating community within the community of St. Louis and giving others an opportunity to know us, and we gave others an opportunity to know you. And I mean, because of you, so many local bands get exposure they would not have gotten. It's like their introduction to a wider audience. It's really great.
Yeah. And people really appreciate that because they always wish that they could do it, but they don't even, you know, have the time or the, you know, wherewithal or however. And so they know the work that you're putting into it. And
I'm trying.
They're glad that you're there doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was originally how I came upon the show. Is you all have been doing your fair share too. Is I remember seeing a segment with Letter to Memphis and River Kittens, Ollie. So those, I mean, they're all friends of my show as well, and I've been trying to do my, like I said, my part to help support them the best I can, and they've all become good friends too. So it's exciting to be a part of it all.
It really is, yeah. And it's interesting, the difference is you're able, you take a lot more time than we do. I've already lost my voice and we haven't started yet.
Did you look behind the refrigerator?
It's still there. So you're able to get in depth, and it's great. But we're doing video, so we have to go a lot shorter. Mm-hmm. And that serves a purpose. It's more of an introductory thing. It's more of a feature, where yours is a really good in-depth interview. And
but
very comfortable to hear.
It's not just music. It's set up really to show, you know, for St. Louis, by St. Louis, about St. Louis, and all St. Louis talent. And, there's just so much here that we... You know, they always say on the news how nobody cares about good stuff. And we actually have a sweet St. Louis moment. and really, it doesn't get the ratings, I guess, that you would if you were, you know, showing people's heads being blown off. But somebody has to say something to champion the city, because we're real proponents for St. Louis.
Yeah. And that's the first thing we learned when we started doing this, that everybody else does want to champion the city. They do care about the city of St. Louis.
And Ryan, you sound so creepy with your voice like that.
I can't help. I'm going Gary Colander on it. I lost my voice 3 days ago. It's just now coming back. So, Joy, this is a great opportunity for you. Just talk all you want.
Yeah.
I'll just kick back every now and then, fade away.
I'm sorry I interrupted you, though, because you were sounding so...
Pretty much made the thought. That's fine.
Yeah, it was almost like the idea of St. Louis one person at a time, you know, to show what we have. And St. Louis, we've lived all over the country, and when... We would actually say to people, they'd say, where are you from? We say St. Louis, and they'd say, oh, is that in Louisiana? They on the coasts, you'd be surprised that people have no clue the flyover states.
Unless they're baseball fans, then they know.
Yeah. But even then, they probably don't know where St. Louis is, which is so unbelievable. And I really, beyond the fact that we have so much here that we don't talk about, we don't market, we just, you know, we've got a bunch of quiet money here. A lot of money. We're one of the leading areas,
old money,
in the country for literacy. I mean, there's so many people who read books here. And what I always say,
charities,
which is, I think it's the best place to be, just to live. You know, when you grow up here, you're always like, well, I can't wait to get out of St. Louis, because you grew up here and you think there's something better someplace else. And it isn't until you go other places that's, I guess, why so many people come back to St. Louis, because they find out, hey, it's actually better here.
Well, you know, there are things better in other cities.
Well, sure.
Every
there's
city
something
has
better
something.
About this or better
sure,
about that.
Sure, but when it comes down to it, though, you go, but St. Louis is really...
And as a place
anchored,
to live, and it sounds so funny, but the CVC, the Convention Visitor Center, they have this slogan that says, St. Louis is all within reach. And I think that's so important.
So is salt and pepper, but, you know.
But stuff that you want to do, that you can do here, like we have a big emerging art scene here now, or even like the restaurant, the Fountain on Locust. I could not have done that.
How long did it take her before she got that plug?
plug! Ding, 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 ding. Because, you know, if I was in New York or Los Angeles, it just would not be within reach to do something like that. Just out of, you know.
You would remain pretty much a neighborhood restaurant in Chicago or New York.
If I could even afford to do that.
Sure,
yeah.
Exactly. But here, people, as the plug continues, they come from O'Fallon to O'Fallon.
Yeah.
They'll come in and they'll come to the Fountain on Locust and think nothing
and
of it.
And musically, I think it's a great platform, because there's a work ethic. The Midwest work ethic,
oh, yeah, definitely,
which supersedes the, you know, the flightiness, I guess you would call it, of some people on either coasts, that they have access to, you know, what you would think would be the places you have to go, labels, you know, businesses, all that stuff for show business and all mm-hmm. that.
2 hours later, Shane asks his second question.
No. You said I could talk.
Yeah, no, this is
you can
great.
Cut that part. Yeah, so anyway, we have a lot of talent here
for sure. Yeah, no, I agree. That's, and that's the thing. Like, I started the show having a fair knowledge of this St. Louis music scene, but I've been discovering, constantly discovering new music all over this town, and that's what makes this show so exciting for me. It's like, you know, as a fan, I'm constantly, you know, discovering more great music all over and becoming a new fan of all these other bands and people that have been doing it for a long time that just never were on my radar. So it's exciting to meet them and then go see shows and all this stuff. So, but yeah, there's no shortage of incredible people in this town.
Even though you will repeat a few because they're favorites and yeah. things have happened, they have a new LP out or whatever. Yeah. LP? EP? No LPs, but CD. EPs now. CDs, EP, LP, DVD.
Yeah, that's the there's so many options now.
Yeah. I mean,
like, before, there's so many letters.
Right, before it used to be the album, you know, the LP. But yeah,
and you could cover it just by saying album,
sure.
new album. That's kind of like whatever.
But yeah, but people, you know, you got your digital release, you got your EPs, you got your, you know, everybody's doing all kinds of different things.
Who started the thing of dropping it?
Yeah.
You know, I'm dropping a new
album.
Yeah,
I don't know about that one.
Well, yeah, where did that come from? Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to stay up with just what you are talking about. Like right now, we don't even know how to say, and technology changes yeah. so fast.
But everybody gets it.
Yeah. But, and it doesn't seem to have a problem. And this podcasting, who knew that this would be what it is, you
sure.
know? And I think it's because people are so... they're so device-oriented now, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit of a lack of the realness in that, and you don't get emotion, and that's why they have the emoticons and all that stuff to send out with emojis, to sure. send out with it. It's like you are hanging on to a podcast as a real
There's
message.
Intimacy
yes,
in a podcast.
Yes. And it's not a... formulatic, you know, radio format kind of a thing that you can't, you know, get the realness of the people.
Yeah.
So
this is
a good thing. I think that's surfacing as well as other things because of that. The whole movement, I think, across the board is to get away from the big companies, the corporates, the conglomerates and all this. In food and drink and anything,
and yeah.
take it back to the level of the kitchen table or the, in this case, the.
Sure. Which, bringing it back to Honest TL is why we did Honest TL. We purposefully wanted it to be local about St. Louis. When we started it, we came from a world of national radio syndication. Joy and I owned a radio syndication company for 30 years where we syndicated to 700 radio stations around the world, most of them in America. And that survived and did extremely well because of the cookie cutter element of radio. Everybody in every city was doing the same thing to save money. And we sucked into that and said, well, okay, well, we'll supply the comedy, you know, and we did for many years. But when we started this, we went the opposite way. We said, we want this to be local, and people in the industry thought we were crazy because when you hit the internet, you're global.
Right.
So why not compete globally? Well, we can't compete globally as Stevens and Gridnick, Ron and Joy. We can locally, though. It's the big fish in a smaller pond. Plus, that local thing gives it a really strong focus and a good focus because people do still respond to community and care about it.
And you know what? I'm going to add something to that, believe it or not.
Jeez, I'm shocked. Usually she just corrects it.
Yeah, just to give some background. I'll do that in that, too. Because you're young, and, you know, we've lived several decades and beyond. So what we did was we were here in St. Louis, and we wanted to do comedy. When he said Stevens and Gridnick, a lot of people probably don't even know what that is.
What is that noise?
I don't know.
Something. It's some kind of a
It's
connection.
Probably the board.
Yeah.
We'll blame it on the board.
It's something with letters involved. Yeah.
I'll go kick it.
But so we started by doing comedy bits, audio comedy bits. Yeah, something over there. But, you know, at that time, it was like,
oh, man.
The only thing you could do for, I'll just keep talking while you adjust
no,
that.
Go ahead, yeah.
We don't know what we're doing.
The only thing you could do as a comedy outlet back then. This was actually before the stand-up movement really, you know, came back again with Steve Martin and all of that. It was that. Did I forget what I was talking about?
The odds are. The odds are pretty good you did. Well, you were adding on to my comment about...
There was no outlet for comedy except working for an ad agency at that time. So we wanted to do... We'd put together a comedy album and an LP.
That was long playing. In 77.
Yeah. And it was so difficult to get anybody to take us seriously. There was before the internet. So we had to move to Los Angeles to get a record deal. And then when we went there just to visit, just to take our album around, because that's how you did it back then, you'd go knock on doors, they'd say, hey, this is really funny, but, you know, who are we investing in here? You guys live in St. Louis, and that's like, you know, what's that? If you're serious about this, you got to move here.
Right.
So we actually moved to Los Angeles because we thought that they weren't going to, there was no way to continue down that path. So we lived there for what, 18 years? No, 9 years. So 9 years, and then we moved to New York, and we did radio all that time. Radio syndication. We started doing funny little morning show comedy drop-ins, funny commercials, song parodies, little character drop-ins.
All the things
like
morning shows use.
Yeah, and I think we have probably over 5,000 of those now.
But who's counting?
Yeah, yeah. and they should go somewhere, in some Hall of Fame somewhere. not just under somebody's bed or in the closet or something.
You can find them on eBay.
Yeah, yeah. And we could bring them back, actually, as some of the things that we thought were funny back then actually happened since then. Like, we made a funny bit once about Doggy King. It was a fast food restaurant for dogs, and they have that now.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, you know.
Do we get royalties? No.
But anyway, we have two albums, and the first one was nominated for a Grammy. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, and so that was the Stevens and Gridnick comedy.
It was called Somewhere Over the Radio. And it was about radio, because that was our background, is what we knew.
Sure.
That's the first thing they teach you in comedy. Talk about what you know. Do what you know most.
But at that time, when we were doing comedy bits, we put this album out, and radio stations didn't know how to play it, because they were so formatted that they didn't know. They were uncomfortable. They didn't know if they should introduce it, like, now here's a comedy piece, or and we just said, just play it. Just put the needle
drop
down.
Drop it down and
right
get out of the way.
Right in the middle of two songs. Right. Yeah. And
that evolved into our syndication.
Exactly. So then we had morning shows, and we still are a part of that. That's been 31 years? 30?
Of what?
Of radio comedy.
Oh, well, we did it. We sold it after 30 years, and it continues.
Well, we still do.
With a company in New York. A company in New York bought it, and they continue it, and I consult them. And I remember back in 1976 when Saturday Night Live, was it 75, 76, Saturday Night Live first started. And they had this, of course, you know, Chevy Chase, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, all these, Dan Aykroyd, all these young people. But they had one guy, Herb Sargent, who was one of the writers on the show, and he was like in his 50s.
Yeah.
And that caught my attention, even though I was 22, 23 years old. I thought, why do they have this old guy on the show? And years later, Joy and I, when we moved to L.A., one of the first guys we met was Bernie Burlstein, who managed all these young people. And he was interested in us, and he put us on writing for WKRP in Cincinnati, which he also managed those people. But I asked him about that. And he said Herb Sargent was a writer who wrote for Carol Burnett, Jack Benny, I mean, these old, old shows from the 50s and 60s. And he was a polished writer. And he said, these young people, they're good, but they haven't made a lot of mistakes yet. And Herb will help them through those mistakes and guide them past them and say, that's a funny idea, but what if you do it like this? But what my takeaway from that was, this guy was in his 50s, came from a different generation, and these people were young and hip, new, young writers, but they had a common language. They had something in common, and that has not changed. To this day, here I work with Jimmy Failla, who is one of the regulars on the Kennedy Show on Fox News, and it's a comedy show, and Jimmy's in his late 20s. And I'm in my 60s, and we just have a ball working together every day writing comedy. He brings something to the table that's new for me, and I bring things to the table that he hasn't thought of yet. And it works.
Right.
Well, yeah. Shane, you know, you can't say one word because...
have you heard his podcast? He doesn't talk much.
When you're talking about this, though, what comes to mind is that humor, to me, you might say music, but I say humor is the language that connects you to people. Because if you think about your group of friends, you might have somebody who is very quiet and they don't talk.
Right.
Well, why do you like that person? It's because they smile at your jokes. They get your humor. To me, humor is the great communicator.
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
And the one that pulls you together and, finds your common bond.
Yeah, I mean, I try to, along with, you know, we mentioned the music and stuff, but I try to have as many different comics around town on the show as well because I'm a huge comedy fan as well. So,
and those are fun. Those are fun to listen to. I think people in comedy like hearing other comedians talk about comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody's got a different voice in it, and that's what I think is great. Like, you know, there's their own take on everything. You know, it's just, especially, obviously, there's people that do one-liners or whatever, you know, things, but any of the comedians that can tell stories and stuff, they always tell stories from personal experiences. So everybody's got a very different voice in it. So,
well, we were comedy writers for years in Los Angeles. We, as he mentioned, we wrote for WKRP in Cincinnati, and the reason they brought us in is because we had a radio background. That was a radio show, but then we went on from that to write for other sitcoms, Facts of Life, Angie, those kinds of things at that time, and then got into writing for variety television, the foul-ups, bleeps and blunders, the bloopers and practical jokes, and anything for monies, and all
time,
of those that were variety shows for the, like, that whole next decade, because that was the comedy world at that time. And writing comedy, you know, it's almost like writing music. You sit and you think somebody else is doing it easier, you know. You think that they're just, like, all of a sudden sitting down and out comes a song, and you don't know that somebody may be sitting there, like we did in our early days of writing comedy for radio, where you had to just put out a lot of product. You couldn't just put out your, you know, same stand-up act and hone it, but it's the same 40 minutes over 10 years. This is something where you have to have fresh every day, you know, all the time.
And there's a lot of that out there now. I mean,
but it would
watch
be,
any late night TV talk shows.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. But it would be hard. Like, we would literally sit on the couch all day and maybe come up with one bit. It was hard. Right. But then, like anything, you do it, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And like he was saying about Herb Sargent, at some point, then you are a professional in that area. Your humor may be outdated, but your style, your technique,
craft is universal. Right.
Yeah,
that's all universal. When I was working at Casey, Joe and I both, we met working at Casey back in the 70s here in St. Louis. And part of the attraction to each other was that we loved making people laugh and loved making each other laugh. And I became the program director, and in 75, I think it was, a record label, Buddha Records, flew me to New York to go to a George Burns concert. George Burns was in his 80s. He was like 85, 86, I forget how old he was, late 80s. And he put out an album. And he was going to do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, was that something God album?
That was the movie God.
I thought that.
No. This was just his stand-up.
Oh,
he was still doing Vegas. He wanted to do it till he was 100.
Alice Cooper was there.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm sitting in the audience
everywhere
to see this show, and the announcer goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Burns," and the audience applauds, and out walked Jack Benny.
Yeah.
Now Jack Benny had not performed on stage probably. Do you know who Jack Benny is, Shane?
I know the name.
Remember the Jack Benny show? It was in like the 50s.
Yeah.
He was a radio star before that. And so was George.
Oh, I just love Jack Benny. He was so vain.
But
he
was also
play up all of his
in his 80s. And
vices.
He had not done a stand-up act probably in 40 years. And he walked out there and held that audience for an hour. And then George Burns came out and did an hour.
Yeah.
And I was blown away by that. At that point in time, I had done stand-up locally and was interested in it. And to have this opportunity to see the show was a big deal for me. And then afterwards, they invited me to the after party. And I was able to stand and talk with George Burns and Jack Benny. And these two, they were like they were still 20 years old.
Right.
I mean, they were on, they were sharp, they were clever. And it really made an impression on me that age really is has very little to do with it if you use it.
Sure.
I mean, they weren't trying to be someone 20. They were being 80, mm-hmm. and they were good at it.
I just saw Don Rickles on...
another great example.
He was on Fallon the other night. And, you know, I think he's 90 now.
He's got to be up there.
Something like that.
And still as acerbic as can be.
Yeah, he's so quick still.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, you can definitely tell his body is aging, but his mind is still very sharp. And he, but yeah, just you know, very quick with Jimmy.
George Carlin did it until he died. And, you know, they changed. If you go back and look at their early stuff, what George Carlin did when he was 20 was different than when he was 70. Mm-hmm. He became just a nasty old bitter old man, and he knew he was, and he used it. You know, he's just good at it.
Well, you know, that's something that you were talking about and I wanted to comment on, where you've got people that are funny. You know, they're just naturally funny, and then you've got people that write funny, and a lot of those people, like Stephen Wright, are, you know, they don't necessarily have to be a performer.
Some people say funny things, and some people say things funny.
Yeah. And I was just thinking the other day, it's so great to be able to say things funny. I always, you know, never mastered that. I'm accidentally funny. But I am not somebody who knows how to, you know, get command.
Her theory is that if you talk long enough, eventually it'll get funny. Because you just
wait
keeps
a minute.
Going
you were just talking a whole bunch. Anyway, the thing about being funny without having funny material, though, is that if that requires you to be on and in the good mood and everything's going right, because if it's not, then you got nothing. You know, then you're bombing.
I always liked somebody. I remember, forget where I first heard it, but somebody said something along the lines about how, like, that kind of comparison about writing and things. Mm-hmm. But like how for Seinfeld, like when they write on the script, like Kramer walks in the room.
Oh yeah, but he's gonna walk in funny. Yeah,
on type, you know, it looks like, oh, it's just, you know, but
exactly
when you see it him act it out, like that's the comedy. So it's like, you know, there's just nobody walks into a room like that. Like, so
there was a show called Mork and Mindy, which starred Robin Williams back in the 70s. It was the 70s, wasn't it? No, 80s. It was in the 80s because we were in LA at the time, and we were working with those teams of writers, and they said all they would write is, Robin Williams is funny, says something funny here, because they knew whatever they wrote, he was going to be funnier anyway, so why bother? And that was the only sitcom where that happened.
I do love when they, with that improv element of it, where they can allow those guys just let them do their thing.
Well, that's gotten to the point now of reality TV. I mean, they don't even need a script anymore.
Right.
You know, they don't have to hire the writing department. It's the, like, the biggest bargain.
It's all in the editing.
But there's so many TV channels. There's so many cable channels. There's so much radio. There's so many things competing for people's attention. Podcasting, everything. You know, radio, the burnt toast in your room, you know, just the newspaper that nobody's reading anymore, the internet. There's so much asking for your moment of attention. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to cut through. There's TV shows that have been on for 6 years that I never heard of. That's how, you know, before it would be like four networks.
I think it's your, there's nothing you can do about it. It's when you're talking that microphone starts to break up. No,
I get this abuse.
You don't even hear it. You don't hear it.
I'm just not going to talk.
No. You want to? We can switch mics if you want.
Oh yeah. It's probably my energy field.
That's what it is.
I shut ATMs down. Yeah. There's something messed up about that. I do hear it, but I don't know. It was doing it before when I wasn't doing anything, I think.
It's the ghost of the studio.
But anyway, so now I lost my train of thought. So I don't know.
Would you look behind the refrigerator?
That's called a callback.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
We're here all night.
Yeah.
Let's do Danny Thomas spit takes. Yes.
So we talked. I mean, you've been in radio with Casey. You've done sitcoms. You've done stand up. You've Now we're,
you know,
now
the stand-up thing, I have to, like, we did an act for a while. We even came back to St. Louis. It was more prop comedy along
but
the
lines.
But
it was to support our albums more than
anything.
Yeah,
because we had a production background, and I was never comfortable, like, standing up and talking to people and having them look at me. I was always scared, and I had stage fright and all this. And, you know, I try to pretend I'm somebody who loves to be in front of an audience. But I hate it. I can't wait to get off because I'm scared to death and I hate it. And I don't know how you ever get over that, but I know other people have had the problem that not Carol Burnett, but the one that Hitchcock used all the time. She would literally throw up. She was so, you know, had such
before each show.
Anxiety. Yeah, before each show.
Didn't Bernadette Peters say she did too?
I don't know, but you know when you were saying that
we're
Jack Benny
these things out
came out and did an hour, he probably did that just because he wanted to. You know,
oh,
he loved it.
He loved an audience.
And yet you have people that can't wait to retire because they, you know, they had to do it in order to get.
Yeah, everybody's different.
Anywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah,
I don't know where you were headed with that, Shane, because you never got to finish the question.
No,
but really, I mean, the real obvious question that will eventually come up is, how did you end up owning a restaurant?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. You guys seem to have done it all. You got the website and all the content there, the restaurant and things. It's like, is there anything still left
that
to do?
The restaurant is Joy. And Joy does whatever she wants to do anytime she wants to do it because she's a doer. She can't rest. She can't sleep. And it's all creative outlet. That restaurant really was more like an art project for her and just became successful because she put her heart and soul into it. And she does credit St. Louis for that. It's, as she was saying earlier, it's a community where you can do that and the community will get behind you and make it a success.
I've never seen a city like that gets behind an underdog and champions them like St. Louis. And I mean, we won this bathroom contest, which was ridiculous because we don't have the best bathroom.
Restroom.
Best restroom
in
America. Yeah, and at the time we were up against really good restrooms that had flat screen TVs and fountains and all kinds of, you know, fancy stuff. But it was also a time when it was Obama, you know, yes we can kind of thing, and it was more of that same attitude to champion the underdog, and we certainly had a funky handmade bathroom.
Right.
But people come in now and they're like, oh,
this
they come
it?
Just to see the bathroom.
Sure.
And it's like, I saw a better bathroom in Albuquerque. And we're like, well, yeah, I know.
But Albuquerque didn't vote for it.
Yeah.
Right.
And the people, there's so many people because this was a one-way street. It was all boarded up. There was nothing here. And nobody in their right mind would have done this. And, of course, I wasn't in my right mind because I didn't know anything what I was doing. So that's how this – it's because of St. Louis voting for us and stuff. And it'll make me, like, get – teary, and I have to try not to cry because it's so nice.
But it's true. They were very, very supportive. And so was the local media.
And that's why we have the best baseball fans. I mean, we have the best fans in St. Louis. But at the same time, they are discriminating. They're not going to get behind bullshit. You know, they are. That's why it's the show me state. You know, show me you're real and what you got, and then I'll get behind you.
That's true.
Going back to what I was saying the beginning with, you know, you guys having me on the segment and stuff, like, that's how I felt, like, the fact that so many people were supportive and shared it and saying so many nice things about, you know, my show and me, and it was just like, it was unreal. Like, I was very emotional
humbled.
For me.
Yes,
like,
you were humbled by it. Yeah, I could tell you were humbled by it, by your response to it.
It was
But they all they recognize that you're doing a good thing, mm-hmm. and they appreciate that. And it's kind of like they're standing ovation for you.
Sure. Exactly. They recognize hard work, and they appreciate it.
So, yeah, you know, same with you. It's cool. It's a very, very cool feeling to have people supporting you like that. So
yeah.
You were saying that it's a restroom, not a bathroom. I laugh because there's a I think it was like Dane Cook had a bit like where, you know, he's talking about called a restroom and he's like, nobody walks in, you know, like runs in there.
Take a rest.
Whew. Yeah, right.
Oh, man.
You know, before I go back, I know I got to rest.
Yeah. That's funny. The bathroom thing that I was thinking, I work at a Oyster Bar part-time and they have like one an original bathroom there You know, and it's like tiny little single stalls.
Oh, yes. The Broadway Oyster Bar. Yeah, you could barely fit in the thing. Some people can't even sit in that room. Yeah. It's so small.
It's the worst than an airplane bathroom. Right.
But, and we have these newer bathrooms that are much larger and everything.
Yes.
And the expansion. And it's like, but people, I always, you know, as a door guy, I'm always like, hey, there's more bathrooms over there. Like, no, we want to use these.
Yeah, we usually get the table right across from that bathroom that you're talking about. That, you know, we like that area right there. And it's amazing how people will stand there and stand there and wait and wait instead of go down to the other one.
Yeah, but it is something, you know, it's got a character to it. You know, it's not your typical standard bathroom.
Plus, St. Louisans are set in their ways, and that bathroom was there first.
Yeah.
And a lot of those customers have been going there for years, and that's just the way it is. It's not going to change.
So it is funny how many people, like you're saying, walking in just to see the bathroom and stuff.
Right,
and like,
right.
It's just, it is funny. I've doing this show, I've got to hang out with Radio Rich Dalton.
Good guy.
I've just had a lot of fun talking with him. And I had learned from Casey as well.
Great.
So I've been able to talk to a few of
radio
personalities around town. You know, not necessarily a lot of the backbone of the show is music and comedians you know, there's other I always leave it open to other interesting people.
That's good. It's good that I think that's the best way to approach it, especially when you're talking people like Radio Rich, who he has a band. He's in a band. He's been a musician all his life, and I don't think there's a more knowledgeable person when it comes to music locally or nationally than Radio Rich.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to go back and listen to that conversation.
He's just a wealth of knowledge.
He's the kind of guy, and he admits this. He'll say, ask me what time it is, and I'll tell you how they make a watch.
Yeah.
He just loves it. I mean, he will go on, you know.
And stories for days, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they're all good.
It's like I said, you both met over at KC.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I saw clear throat.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I make people do that because my voice is so gravelly.
Well, when you hear somebody else doing it, you clear your throat for them.
I think we had that same problem when we were...
We did in there. Yeah, that's right, on the video interview. We both kept clearing our throat. I cut that stuff out. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, it turned out much better.
We were in there going...
Well, this... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to... So what gets you... getting started in radio, like this is a technically radio.
Right? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, audio format.
But as I pointed out in our interview and video, you can't do this on the radio.
That's
you know?
Right.
This is so
that's
great.
That's why I got into radio because I thought radio would be a stepping stone to getting on a sitcom.
Yeah, sure.
But you know what? That would have been a terrible thing for me because radio is the freest way to get to your creativity right to where it needs to go without another million hands in the pie, editing and censoring and all this other problem. Especially this whole podcast format, which we're saying is even better than radio. But radio is immediate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the TV costs so much and it's so difficult to get footage right away edited and put out, I mean, it's immediate. Radio, you're right there. If there's a flood and it happens right now, you can open up the microphone and be right there, which is why it's so bad that radio became satellite and, you know, not local and formulated and all of this stuff that prevented people from speaking. And it kind of killed the radio personality.
The real talents of radio left radio and went on, and there's so many availabilities or opportunities in television now.
Really what happened
cable TV
was a lot of there were a lot of buyouts in the behind
in the 80s.
Yeah, so that insurance companies would buy broadcast stations, and then they would look at the roster and they'd say, oh, the midnight guy is making $3 an hour and the morning show guy is making a $300 an hour. Something's wrong. Let's get rid of him and let's get somebody else in there in the morning. Well, there goes your flagship talent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then all these great, you know, Larry Lujacks of the world lost their jobs. And they usually ended up with one in each city. But many of them were displaced and out of work. And so then what did you have? Boring radio. And
with no talent development.
Yeah, and then the ratings fall. So they look at that and they're like, well, why is this falling? It's because we're not playing the right music and we're not playing it in the right order and the people are talking too much. So let's have them not talk at all and let's just put these sets together. And it became all about
that. People talking too much came from that golden question, which do you prefer, music or talk? Well, ask anybody that, and they're going, whoa, music, you know, talk is bad. They were conditioned to believe that talk is bad, and talk can be bad, but it isn't always bad, and when you have a good talent, talk is good.
Mm-hmm. Especially can support the music, because right. everybody can play the same
it
music.
It adds context.
But sure. not everybody yeah. can have the same talk.
What music on the radio has in common with comedy is the ability to put it in context. Every comedian knows that a line they deliver in the right context kills. The same line in a wrong context doesn't work. And music works the same way. You actually create the context within which you present the music. KDHX locally does it better than anybody.
Well, you know what? I was just listening to KZQZ on the weekend.
KZQZ?
I know. It's got a crazy format during the week.
On the east side.
Where they don't even do music. But
1380 AM.
But on the weekends.
Terry Fox.
Yeah, Terry Fox, who's we spent
Kevin
some
McCarthy
radio time
in the mornings.
Is that who's on in the morning?
Kevin McCarthy.
Well, anyway, this is a weekend. So they were playing a bunch of oldies, good oldies, with old commercials like Doubleman Gum and stuff from the.
That's,
so you, it sounded
context.
Like you were listening to old radio. I mean, they put the whole thing together, and they talked up the songs. Yeah. And today, if somebody talked up a song, you would be so annoyed and angry. But in that context, talking up
sounded
the song
great.
Was that's a master that can you know sure. do that and do that right, and it just keep it going. And those are the guys before
right.
the DJs of you know the dance.
Yeah. And you know,
era.
And that's why podcasts work, because there is a context within which. People like it. They can put headphones on or earbuds in and walk or jog or sit and work and listen. It's an intimate setting for the podcast. And once that setting was recognized, podcasters from Adam Curry on just, you know, ran with it.
Yeah. I'm a big Stern fan, and he still does the talk up every now and then. He'll do like the top five, just you know, stay current.
Weak.
Yeah,
it's an art,
and he basically just makes fun of it. Like you like,
sure.
yeah. But he'll always do the hey, morning everybody.
Yeah, you know, the puking DJ.
Once you, if you've ever done it at all, right? He was on WABC in New York, then WNBC, I think, at doing top 40.
Right.
I mean, that's where he started too. And yeah, once you've done it. It's in your blood. You can't get it out.
Right, yeah. It just makes me laugh though, how much he, you know, he just tries to nail the...
the post.
The post. Yeah, right. So he's... Because it was so ingrained into him. Like, that's what he had to do. And, you know, obviously...
If you ever went to a radio DJ party and they got drunk enough, that's what they would do. They would put records on and compete with each other, putting on records you've never heard before and to see if you could talk it up.
But you know what I just realized? You were saying that this, you know, Stern, it was a classical, you know, top 40 DJ before he became who he is. And it's the same thing with art, like fine art, because you have a lot of people like Picasso and, well, Salvador Dali that developed a style that you say, oh, like, not Salvador Dali, but many abstract artists that you would think, oh, well, anybody can do that. And yet,
well,
you're amazed to see that they started as, like, the masters, and they painted
they learned art.
Very, very right. well. And you would think, well, why didn't they keep doing that? It was because everybody was doing that, and if you looked at that painting,
sure.
you wouldn't know who did it. And yet, if you look at a Picasso, right away you know who it is, because it's a style
right.
that sticks out.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is, and probably the same for music, or really any form of art, it's all based in money at the end. So when somebody is buying art, there's many people who buy it because they love it. But there are a lot of people who don't know what's good. They don't know what is, you know, it's subjective. So they just want a statement that they spent money. So the thing hanging on their wall is not because it goes with their sofa. It's because it speaks that they can impress you with the fact that they afforded it, which is why a lot of artists will write their name real big on the canvas. Because right away, this is why we have our name on jeans or on
right.
sweatshirts and things. Because you know that somebody paid for that, you know, a brand that would cost more. And that kind of got out of hand, really. And I think maybe it's going back to being, taking that away a little bit.
You probably had that conversation with more than one band. Bands, when they're newer, younger, they really don't want to play just one style of music and be pigeonholed into that style. But in the old world of music, and that would be the 80s and 90s, the record labels required that. You know, they need to know, are you a hard rock band? Are you heavy metal? Are you grunge? What are you? Because that's what we have to sell. And once you've said that's what you are, you have to stay that. And musicians, by nature, because of their creativity, really don't want to have to do that. They'd like to be able to get on stage and break into a country song if they feel like it. Today, there's more of that, fortunately, right, because there's a lot more indie rock, and it's possible to do what you want to do when your followers get that. Mm-hmm. But for many, many years, they couldn't do that and succeed.
It's the best with anything. Like, actors always say, oh, sure, we're getting pigeonholed. I played a superhero. I can get her superhero.
Look at Paul Rubens, who played Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
When he was in The Groundlings in Los Angeles, he had many characters that were far superior to Pee Wee Herman. Hilarious characters he did on stage. But Pee Wee Herman always got that big response.
And you know what's funny about that? Some CBS executives came to a show once when he was doing the Pee Wee Herman show, and they thought, this is a great kids show, not even knowing it was a whole spoof.
Yeah.
and a parody of kids shows, and they put it on the air, and then he had to clean it up, that it would be a real kids show.
Without losing the spoof, though. I mean, he stuck to that. But fast forward, say, 3 or 4 years later, he realized he became a prisoner to his own success.
Right.
Yeah. It was very difficult for him to get movie roles and other roles without being Pee Wee Herman, and he wanted to be able to do that.
Yeah, you see a lot. Like, I think there's guys like some of them are able to pull it off, but you got guys like Robert Downey being Iron Man, like you're saying, being the superhero and stuff. But he's still able to, you know, go and play something completely different and things now.
Sure. Well, the lesson there is you can do a lot of drugs and go to jail and still succeed.
But it's even like, if you can't describe in a short sentence, it's hard to brand whatever it is you're doing. And like, even in the music industry, if you're going to be all over the place, it's going to be hard for somebody to say what it is. It's going to be harder for somebody to sell it. So if the simpler is, you know, see ya, if it's just see ya is your thing. You can take that kind of far, kind of fast, you know?
Right.
It's the subtleties and the more complicated stuff that emerge slower.
Yeah.
Well, look at the number of actors who say, I don't want to be a star, I want to be a successful actor or actress.
Exactly, because that takes
becoming a star
from,
gets in the way.
Yeah.
That's kind of a bucket list thing for me is I would just kind of be in like even just one line or something in a movie, just to have a walk on spot, like
it'll happen,
whatever it is. But yeah, I just think it'd be fun,
you know what, though, I have to tell you, because I was in a big movie once, and I was so disappointed with the what you have to do. You have to get up
process.
At like 3 and be there at 5 and then sit around
all day.
All you do is sit around for your scene, waiting for your scene. And I can't stand that. You're just waiting. You bring a book, you bring, you know, some lunch or whatever, or you just. To me, that lifestyle is like killing.
I was in a movie once with Smokey Robinson.
Sure.
And it was in L.A., and we were partners in crime in this movie. It was produced by Motown. And I had to do that sitting around all day, but I had to sit in a sports car with Smokey Robinson. We sat up on a hill in a sports car for about 2 hours waiting for the director to get everything right before we drove down to the house. And those were like 2 hours I would never want to give back, though, you know, because I'm sitting with Smokey Robinson, and it's like, after about 20 minutes past the Chris Farley phase of it, you know, of, oh, God, why'd I say that? Oh, no! Idiot! Then it became a conversation, you know? I mean, no, you don't normally get that opportunity. When we were working for WKRP, we went to Denny's with Lonnie Anderson and other members of the, and we were sitting like having hamburgers with Lonnie Anderson. Like, okay, that's a nice way to talk with Lonnie Anderson, eating hamburgers.
That Farley, I always laugh thinking when, you know, he's hanging out with Paul McCartney, and he's
a classic interview.
And he's one that says things funny. Yeah.
You remember when you were in the Beatles, and you know, like,
but McCartney played that so well.
Yeah,
it's like,
sure.
Yeah, I remember. Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Another classic McCartney interview was with Steve Colbert. Did you ever see that one?
I don't think so.
Steve Colbert actually challenged him. You know, with the Colbert ego.
Yeah.
There's McCartney in there, and Colbert going saying stuff like, so. So the Beatles, huh?
Yeah.
Really, the Beatles. And Paul goes, yeah. And you've heard of the Beatles, right? And Steve looks at him and goes, have you heard of me? And this conversation that was supposed to be an interview just kept more tense and more tense as it went along. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Look that one up. It's on the internet.
Yeah, will do. So, so I mean, you mentioned hanging with Smokey, Jack Benny, you know.
weird conglomeration all these of people.
Like, who's the one that you guys are like,
who's our biggest?
Yeah, I mean, like the thing that is most important to you, like the biggest, like inspiration or anything like that you've been able to meet.
Well, the least inspirational was Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah,
we Joe and I did this comedy special once.
You'll just answer the.
No, let's go to the bottom. Yeah. Start and work our way up. But that's a teaser for a story that's going to come for those who don't know the convention. We did a one-hour comedy special for national radio called the Rock Bottom Comedy Special, and we asked several rock stars of the day at the time, that they were all top stars: Ozzy Osbourne, Ted Nugent, Bob Welch, who I think was he with Fleetwood Mac? No, he had his own LP then, his own thing, and Al Stewart, who was big at the time, to do comedy bits with us. And Ozzy said, okay, we were out in L.A. at the time. He goes, I'm up in the Hollywood Hills at my manager's house. Come on over here and we'll
He's shooting birds, by the way.
So, yeah, we show up and
that's what he was
guns.
Doing.
He's shooting birds in the Hollywood Hills where houses everywhere, you know, and he's using rifles. And so we have a photo of us. He says, hold these rifles and point them to my head so this photographer will take a photo for the trades. And we're holding them to his head, and after we're done, we realize these rifles are still loaded.
Right.
Didn't bother him at all.
Yeah.
But anyway, he could not – we would give him a simple script, and he could not do it. And he was struggling
He was illiterate.
Yeah.
And we finally realized he didn't know how to read.
Huh.
And
we went through the whole script once, me doing his part. Once it was done, he knew it.
Yeah, he picked up on our – you know, he Real had bad. The ability to immediately remember what it is because he had to do that in life. And so he could do it right away. He had Ozzy tattooed on his fingers here, so O-Z-Z-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, oh, that's how he can remember how to spell his name.
Yeah.
But because of our work with Keishi and radio syndication, we met a lot of the artists, the musicians of the time. And again, I guess it's that they were at a point in their lives where they were successful. They were fun. I did a radio show in London for 2 weeks, and Chaz Chandler, who was the bass player for the Animals, Eric Burden and the Animals, then he managed Jimi Hendrix, and then he managed a group called Slade. He felt he owed me a favor, so he called me up when I was on the air, said, when you get off the air, I'm going to take you and Joyce. Joy was with me to some private clubs, and we went, and Elton John was there, and Peter Sellers was there, and it was really a cool thing. And he had this gold Rolls Royce convertible.
Yep.
We're cruising around the streets of London in 4 in the morning, stinking drunk, standing up in a gold Rolls Royce convertible, singing songs, oldies together and stuff. Those are great moments, and they're fun. But there was no real sense of inspiration in there, like meeting George Burns or Jack Benny, people like that. To be honest, when we interview young musicians in St. Louis today, that's more inspiring.
Yeah.
Because they're hungry, and they're really into their art. And
you
it's
just
fun
bumped
to meet
the
them.
Mic, and I think that's where the problem's coming from.
Whatever.
But you know, you're missing the question. The question.
Who
is? I think now it's all screwed up.
You're rebumping.
Yeah. But he's saying, who do we look up to? Who?
Yeah, right. Well,
I hear you that you're saying that, you know, the inspiration, you can identify with that kind of, that is inspiring.
This is called Joy Grinnick post-analysis of Ron Stevens'
yeah,
answers.
Yeah, I have to do that because he didn't answer the question.
Go ahead.
In comedy, for instance, I liked Steve Martin a lot.
Right.
I appreciated what Phyllis Diller did, and as a woman, I could identify with her having to make herself look funny, because people don't think you're funny unless you look funny. At least they did back then.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a, you know, a big deal.
I thought he meant people we met.
Oh,
but you did meet Phyllis Diller. You worked with Phyllis Diller.
Yeah, I did. I worked with Phyllis Diller. And
you met Steve Martin for a split second.
On the street.
Well, we went to a party he was at. But we're on the streets in New York, and she goes, there's Steve Martin. He just walked right by. Zoom.
He's so big. He's large. He's a large man.
He was walking very fast.
Hands. I was so surprised. One time I ran into Al Franken on the street, too. And I said, we actually had a friend who was married to a guy who was a spitting image of Al Franken. So I didn't know
his
if it
was
Al Franken or this guy, Sean. So I went up to him. I said, are you Al Franken? And he said, yes.
No, you did not. You went up to him and said, are you Sean?
Oh, that's right.
This is on the streets of New York, busy streets. She just walks right up to him and says, are you Sean? He goes, no. She goes, are you Al Franken? He goes, yes. She goes, okay, and walks away.
But then Al Franken and I did a show together here
in St. Louis. Right,
yeah, there was a time when I was doing these
before
short
he was a senator.
And he was still in radio, and he was coming through, and he was on some radio station that I was on.
She was on his national show.
Yeah, so. and the people from St. Louis came to see me more than him, and they couldn't believe it. And so Al Franken's like, who's this? You know, like.
So you reminded him?
He tried to get in my pictures, yes.
Did you tell him the story, the New York story, where you thought he was Sean?
We just said that.
Did you tell him that?
Oh.
Did you tell Al Franken that?
I don't remember, Ron.
Okay. But you remember we just talked about it.
Oh, you know what? Actually.
That's important.
Actually, I do. I did tell him that. And he
had
no memory of that. Yes.
Well, I would think he wouldn't.
Right. He probably has people come up to him on the street all the time.
Just asking if he's Sean.
Yeah. Sure. I'm not saying. How come Joy has more people here than you? Yeah. So. Yeah.
Okay. So, but he was not an inspiration to you. Now that he's a senator, are you
inspired? Oh, I like Al Franken, and he's funny. Yeah.
But have you noticed that on the Senate floor, he does everything he can to not be funny.
Yeah.
You know, he's serious.
Right. He's
but
trying
you
to
can tell he really
have
there's so many times he wants to say it.
Yeah.
It is funny that that now he's a senator, and then you got guys like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger or Jesse the Body in office too, and it's just kind of it's kind of weird.
Is why Donald Trump thinks he can do
it. Yeah, or Ronald Reagan even.
Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild before that. He was the governor of California, so he kind of worked his way up. He didn't go from reality TV to president.
Yeah, but it is it is funny when you know them in a different light.
And shows you what a popularity contest it really is.
Yeah. So I was remembering that inspiration that we had as a team, because for a while we were a comedy team, mm-hmm. but we were never what people expected, so it didn't really work out. It was people, there's a husband-wife team. They expect some husband-wife humor, but we were never doing that. So so that kind of worked against what people want or expect, and then you have to, you know, it's harder.
When we did our morning radio show in New York, we did, though. I mean, we'd go on air and just argue.
But I always wanted to do a comedy album like The Bickersons, and this is really old because it's way before our time, too. But we found this old comedy album of The Bickersons, Donna Michi, and I forget what her name was even. It was an actress in the golden days
of radio. It was like Nichols and May.
Nichols
and May are also back to the 50s.
Nichols and May,
kind of like
you were
that.
Great. But
they played just a husband
and
wife.
Never made me laugh like The Bickersons. Right. Yeah. And there were a bunch of actual couples that were Burns and Allen and, you know, the Fibber McGee and Molly and all of those groups. But I think the Bickersons, they were arguing all the time, but they were hilarious the way they argued. And since we argue, as you've noticed, I thought we could make something funny out of that, but we never did.
Right. We did go through a phase though in L.A. where when we started getting the attention of television and producers, they wanted us to be that husband and wife thing as well. But they also saw the Nichols and May thing. And Nichols and May, Mike Nichols became a director. Elaine May also directed and wrote movies.
Yeah, she directed Ishtar, the worst big bomb of all.
But it was our favorite movie. It was very, very funny. We were the only ones in the theater laughing at it. In fact, we were the only ones in the theater.
I actually wrote her a letter. I wrote her a letter because I felt so badly that it was bombing so much and she was getting so much critical, criticism, and I thought, God, this, I have to give her some support.
but at one point, the Playboy Channel, I guess it's still around, I don't know, but it was a prominent cable channel for many years. they thought they saw us as Nichols and May, so they hired us to do Nichols and May kind of humor on the Playboy Channel. And fortunately, you know, we didn't have to strip, but it gave us an opportunity to do something a little bit different, and we assumed that nobody we knew would ever see it because it was the Playboy Channel. Boy, were we wrong.
Yeah.
Turns out a lot of people watch the Playboy Channel.
So what's the secret to keeping this all together, being you know, a couple, and then being business partners and everything else?
Yeah,
too.
Really, it's tough.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what, it is tough.
Yeah.
Anybody.
Well, it was toughest when we were just doing comedy together.
That was what we would fight about.
We both have a passion for it.
Yeah, we would not fight about stuff other couples would fight about, like you didn't, you know, wash your socks or whatever. We would fight about.
And I do wash my socks.
I knew something was funny, and he didn't think it was funny, or vice versa. And
sure.
Everybody, you know, women, right. Women have a different sense of humor as a generality for a gender.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it is true.
Yeah.
And so I was like fighting for my cause, and yeah. We would like, you know, boy, it would get ugly there.
Yeah. Right. When we did a radio show in New York, they hired us based on our reputation and our humor. And what they didn't realize, and none of us realized, that it wasn't going to be a typical morning show where the male controlled the show and the female was a sidekick, and that's what they expected. Joy will not be a sidekick yeah. ever in her life. We were equals behind the microphone, and it really made interesting dynamics in radio that it wasn't easy for them to control, and it wasn't easy for anybody to control. So, but it was fun to listen to, because mm-hmm. we would just out of nowhere break into an argument and think it's just fine, and everyone else in the room would be like, oh my God, what's going on?
That's when Howard Stern started talking about us, because
yes,
we actually beat him in the ratings at one point in New York. But the first time we went on the air there, they were expecting us to be this, you know,
top 40 DJ.
Yeah, talking like this, just like you were talking before, where, right. You know, you got your pat, you know, top 40 announcing voice. And we turned on the mics, and we started talking, and it was the first day, and everybody, like a lot of the staff had
they were there
in their pajamas.
In the morning,
they came in with, you know, a food cart, and they wanted to welcome us, and it was a big deal. And when we started talking, the program director's face fell, and he runs in, and he whips the microphone off, and he goes, oh my God, the microphone was on. And
we said,
we were talking.
And he looked at us and goes, but you weren't...
You were talking.
Doing radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we do. We talk.
So they went in, and then all of a sudden we were the fresh new sound. And all of this because we weren't talking that much.
But Stern was like that. I mean, Stern did it like that, but we were on a hot dance station. It was
right.
Top 40 hot dance, very much like 107.7 or 96.3 here, you know, where... They don't even do it that way. New York is very, very special market. You can go on that mic and you can scream, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of energy that goes into it. You can lose 10 pounds in one show. It's amazing.
Yeah. You were saying about the different sense of humors and stuff. I'm a newlywed. I still we'll be approaching 2 years together.
Congratulations.
Or married, but 7 years together.
Nice.
And but yeah, all the time
don't,
I'm like,
don't do anything together.
Oh yeah,
that's the answer. That's
then you'll stay together.
Right.
Go ahead.
But I, you know, I'll find something on, you know, YouTube or whatever, some funny clip, and I'm like, you know, think it's the funniest thing, and I'll try to show it to her, and just she doesn't get it at all. Like
girls don't watch the Three Stooges.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just, but you know, then it would be the complete opposite. She'll bring something to me that she thinks is funny, and
right,
I just add and no, I don't.
But let me guess, she never thought it was funny that a guy put a bottle rocket up his butt and lit it. Didn't see the humor
right,
in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what's funny about that is the second guy who did it and the third guy. After it's been on YouTube and everyone laughed at it, someone else still does it.
Right. Yeah.
Still scorches their ass and doesn't understand what went wrong.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's just funny. Well, there's a lot of stuff, and we do as a couple, and we make each other laugh so much, and I'm like, this would be, you know, a good, like, sitcom or something, like, you know,
yeah,
like stuff
yeah.
like these moments yes. like that, and, like, I try to figure out how to, like,
capture that.
That's the trick.
Yes.
Right.
That's the trick. I mean, that same feeling happens to individuals. They go, you know, I go to parties, and I throw these jokes out there, and the people love it and everything. certainly I can do this on stage. And they get up on stage and it's like, whoa, my God, it's very different up here. Because on stage, it's premeditated. It's rehearsed to a degree. I mean, you have to go up there with some jokes, you know, and you can mix it in with spontaneity, but there's got to be jokes there. And one of the things that a stand-up comedian has to learn is how to read an audience, how to understand the dynamics going on there, because without it, it's just you on a stage and there's this piece of glass between you, you know. Sure. Do you ever go to a show where they do that? They've done that in St. Louis where they'll put the comedian in a back room on a camera and there's a screen on stage and the audience is watching, so the comedian can't see the audience to watch them fail. Uh-huh. And it's funny because these are good comedians who are really seasoned at what they do, right, and they just can't do it because the audience isn't there to feed it back.
Huh.
You know?
Nah,
it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely something about the energy, you know, like having that live element of it. But
well, like anything, it's just it's a craft, sure, and you get better at it by doing. And you know, people don't see that; they think that you're up there talking. I can get up there and I can talk, and they're, you know, not taking into consideration because they just don't know all the other things that go with it.
When we first moved to LA, we did what everybody does. You join an improv group because improv is so good for you. I don't care what you do in life. It's a great way to take chances, learn to put yourself out there and fail in front of people and get funny at failing. And the director of it was a guy named Danny Mora, who was actually in a music group called Up With People. Remember that group?
Yeah, and they had a hit.
A hit.
At one time.
Yeah. Well, it was Back on the Streets Again, written by Steve Gillette, who became a friend of ours.
It was actually a more of a West Coast hit.
Yeah.
We didn't realize that from the Midwest,
St. Louis,
that there
though.
Were different regional hits.
Yeah. But
of course, we knew,
we played here.
Being
yeah.
from Casey, you know, yeah. this is the ultimate prophecy, didn't play anywhere else.
So Danny, he also did sitcoms. And this was very early on, and I mean, it was the early 70s, and Steve Martin was just surfacing, and Saturday Night Live wasn't even on yet. And he started the very first class with, "I have good news for everybody here. There would be plenty of work in comedy for all of us." And he had no idea how right he was, what it would grow to. And every year, comedians say, "Well, this has got to be the last year. There's nothing else funny to do. It's just over. It never ends. It just keeps going because we need comedy so much."
Right.
But, you know, it takes somebody to come along and change it. But with staying within the same
the rules.
Rules.
The basic
yeah,
rules
like
of comedy.
Like David
right.
Letterman, he did The Tonight Show, only he did it with a different attitude, and he did it, you know, he just spoofed it, really.
Right. And then, and now someone's tops that. And
but it's something that everybody's
better.
Comfortable with because they recognize this is a talk show, this is the evening.
There, what you do is you set rules and conventions, and everyone, including the audience, understands and agrees on those rules and conventions. Then you break them.
And then it's the same thing with Steve Martin, who I really, you know, admire for doing the same thing with stand-up. I think I kind of credit him for coming, bringing the stand-up back. Up till then, you know, you had the vaudeville, and you had the trite and really not popular anymore stand-up comedy stuff. And then he turned that around by doing inventive, original, and just a whole different approach to it, which made a lot of people get into stand-up comedy.
For sure.
And that wave is still going, I think, from that. It's where is it going to go next is the question. Who's going to come up with something? Because you have so many styles of people doing so many different things, performance art, so many different things on stage that are inclusive of that. But what's the next major changer?
Topless stand-up. Watch for it.
Right.
It's total rear nudity.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll look to wrap this thing up, let you all get on your way, but this has been incredible. This is a real treat. I thank you for taking some time out to. I mean, obviously, you guys are very busy with everything going on. Like we mentioned, with the on STL.com and the restaurant and Fountain on Locust here. But yeah, so thank you for doing this. So what we got on STL? You got Facebook and all that. Twitter as well.
Yeah, you can go to on STL. O-N-S-T-L. com as well. Yeah. And we're updating that website to include podcasts.
Yeah.
And you'll be the first we'll ask if you want to be a part of it.
Whoa, so. All right. Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to. Anything I can do to help, I'm glad to be a part of it. So is there anything coming up?
We are opening a distillery.
Yeah.
Yes. It's going to be one block east of the fountain, and it's called Tempest Distilling and Spirits Company. So you can come and drink there.
All right.
That'll help out. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's put a podcast room in the back.
Yeah. We've been working on it. Actually, Ron doesn't work on it. I have a different partner on that project, but Ron, you know, contributes however he can. He's going to be drinking there, I hope.
Yes. There'll be a stool with my name on it.
Yeah. But we've been, my partner and I have been working on that for almost over five years.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Over 5 years.
Your tenacity just amazes everybody.
But we're getting closer here.
Yeah.
We're one block down the street. We've got our tanks in place, and, you know, but everything takes longer. The fountain took 2 years to get it open. You know, there's just so much.
And now it's been around 8 years.
Yep.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Very successful.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, very cool. Well, I wish you all continued success with everything.
The same
with,
to you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. This is great.
Yeah. Hopefully, we'll do some live podcast or something in the Tempest or something something like that. Who knows? You know.
And you never get to hear beyond the podcast, so I'll tell you right now. 10 minutes from now, this is what I'm going to hear. Ron, why did you say that? Why did you tell them that? You didn't have to say that. So we got it all now.
Just that's just a little sneak peek.
You can cut it out.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And again, check out onstl.com.
Thank you, Shane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.